Well, thank you for coming in after lunch. Hopefully, we deserve all of this. All. Our lively discussion should lighten the mood. So, first off, I just wanted to mention I'm Sean Foreman, creator of Baseball Reference. And tomorrow morning, I'm having in the Pueblo room from 8 to 10, just kind of an open discussion if you want to learn more about Baseball Reference, some of the secrets, some of the things you might not have been able to find before. I'm going to be in there and going to answer your questions. We also, for all the attendees, there's a card on the table outside where you can get a free 1 month trial for the Play Index on Baseball Reference. So just pick that up and give it a try. And hopefully you'll enjoy it. I'm very excited to be here. My office has an entire wall of bookshelves. I think half of them are by panelists today. We have a tremendous group here. And I could spend a whole hour probably reading the bios just of our panelists.
Please do.
They'll stay for the second hour.
I will give them the briefest of intros. By no means needs complete. So Gary Gillette, in the middle, is and was, among many other things, a Sabre board member, old Tiger Stadium defender, and editor of the ESPN Baseball and Football Encyclopedias. Dick Kramer, immediately to my right, is and was, among many, many other things, a founder of the Sabre Statistical Analysis Committee, a founder of Stats, Inc., and an MIT PhD and a world-renowned computational chemist. John Thorne, at the far right, is and was, among many, many other things, an editor, author, and publisher of Baseball and Football Encyclopedias, a New York City historian, and perhaps the leading expert on the origins of baseball as well. So please welcome our panelists. Now briefly, since I have a lot of questions here, when did you realize that statistics and analysis, baseball statistics and baseball analysis, was going to be a big part of your life? What led to that conclusion?
Well, it's just one step at a time. For me, it's always been a hobby that I had the opportunity to do something. It's almost innate. You asked what I did as a computational chemist. It's pretty much the same thing I do as a staple nutrition, only, and the sociological nutrition is the same. If you see a scene out of Moneyball, I can imagine that happening in the world of drug discovery. You know, different kinds of people find different kinds of roles, but different kinds of issues, but it's insane versus analysis. It's very natural. It's almost as natural for me as breathing. It's some sort of genetic thing, I almost say. Once it happened, once it was possible, I was going to do it.
I think it was the mid-80s. Bill James asked me to help out with Project Sporting when I started. By the second year when it was incorporated, I was asked to be on the board of directors. By the third year, it was consuming almost all my time. And I decided it was more fun than making money. So I sold my business and started with baseball. And it drew a lot more fun.
I love the stats and the cards more than I love the game itself. I learned to read off the backs of baseball cards and was able to memorize statistics despite myself. It wasn't a matter of particular effort on my part, it's just a strength and gift. When I went to college, I was a double major in English and math, which is a peculiar combo. And, I saw the fork in the road, and as Yogi advised, I took it. And I went both ways. I went with literature, and I went with mathematics. And when I was writing the relief pitcher in 1978-79, I was working on index cards, computing save percentages and complete game percentages for teams and leagues. So there are many of you out in the audience who began the same way, with pencil and paper. As an aside, I would say that as a freshman at college, I was instructed to arrive with a slide rule and be sure that I knew how to use it. Of course, by the end of that freshman year, the slide rule gave way to the pocket calculator. And I thought that this adventure in statistics that really began when I met Pete Palmer in 1982 would have run its course by now. Clearly, it did not.
John, where do you pinpoint the start of sabermetrics? Is it all the way back to Chanwick, or is it
I think Bill James, who invented the term, would agree with me. Sabermetrics is not a new thing, but rather it's a cast of mind. It's an approach to the game where you are not going to accept received wisdom. You are going to do your own work, and you're going to be wary what others say. Everything is worthy of investigation, and it's worthy of investigation on a primary basis. Do the work yourself. Verify the findings. I think the sabermetric approach works as well for the practice of history as it does for statistics.
I think it does go back to the mid-19th century. You were quantifying. John, I covered this last night. It's now. And that what really happened is that sometime in the early 20th century, sabermetrics, just called baseball statistics back then, went to dormancy. And except for a few people, a handful of people, like Lanigan, Bridge, Rippey, and that, it just wasn't in use, and therefore it needed to be reborn in the 70s and 80s with pioneers like Dick Kramer, Pete Conger, Bill James, John Thorne.
But why do you think it went into dormancy? Any theories?
It's like lots of other things, that what was once cut against became accepted, and the conventional wisdom took over, and people stopped inquiring, stopped improving, stopped questioning. It was, we have these stats, we don't get any other stats. And some stats were grudgingly accepted, you know, but by the 1920, pretty much everything was said, except for people like sex lives and cross feelings and that. And all of a sudden, what became quest for better information became accepted wisdom, which became dogma, ossified, you know, knowledge.
And this characterized the ossification of styles of play. So when integration came around via Jackie Robinson, he brought back via the Negro Leagues a dead ball style of play that was already an anachronism in the Negro Leagues.
Well, I think I'll put it with the personal computer. Because, for example, the reason Pete and I we're fortunate enough to be able to get started at the start because we had professional access to computers to begin with for other reasons. And once you have the computer and the cast of mind that we all share, it's just a matter of you're going to do it because it was there. So once the personal computer came out and gave the ability to do this kind of stuff to anybody who cared about it at all, and then the data by the same token became available, I think those are the events, the new capabilities, the new accessibility of those capabilities that made this all possible.
So we've gone from self-published works on mimeographs to a situation where Brad Pitt has probably made more money on sabermetrics than anybody else. are you surprised by
that? Well, he needed it more.
Maybe Michael Lewis.
Michael Lewis is probably up there as well. So we'll name one to you.
The two most famous sabermetricians of all.
Yes, exactly. So at what point, did you start to think this is going to be really big? I mean, are you shocked at where it is now, or did you expect this? Just kind of keep going.
Well, actually, we call ourselves sabermetricians, but when Pete and I were doing this back in the 70s, it was only with a great deal of lobbying and a fair amount of, actually, I sent a survey out to Saber members that we could get, I got Bob Davis to grudgingly agree we could do one sabermetric article, either Pete or I could, every 2 years. And that's reality. And I'm sure the same undercurrent still exists in Saber. So you can just imagine the transformation. But certainly for me, the moment was like, you have these sort of wild-eyed fantasies about how something like OPS is going to turn the scoreboard maybe someday. And the Saber Media in Boston, it was on the scoreboard. And to me, that was the moment of truth. But this stuff, oh, God, you know, it was the most incredible feeling that we'd actually accomplished something.
I will note, the Phillies held out until this past year. They had, man, it looked out on the
I think there are several defining moments. One was when Bill James had his first baseball after conversation publisher and became a bestseller. That told me, because I had some of the earlier ones, not all of them, and that told me it was really a big deal. Another thing was the entry into the field of Pilates with their book, because they didn't want to do James Boggs, you know, in some part of the establishment trying to get them out. Another was when I was sitting at Veterans Stadium in Burlington, maybe Stadium 91, and I saw a flash on the scoreboard at the beginning that said somebody's birthday message, and in essence saying the statistics for Major League Baseball are provided by the Major League Baseball IBM Baseball Information System or Service. I remember the BIS back then was not Baseball Info Solutions. It was the official mashup of MLB and MGM, which was pretty much a disaster for several years. And I thought, boy, you know, this is really taking hold. And of course, I think when the club started hiring psychometricians as consultants, and then as the equivalent of assistant general manager, there's been a progression of benchmarks, but some of them are here now, sort of forgotten. Elias book disappeared after 5 or 6 years.
For me, there are several such benchmarks. When Pete and I did the Hidden Game of Baseball in 1984, we were certainly riding the crest of Bill James' first two commercially published abstracts that came out in 82 and 83. But we were stunned when the New York Times picked up some of the alternative linear weights measures and ran them 3 times a week for 3 years. So when the New York Times koshers your work product, that makes you pay attention. And our ability to get a big-time commercial publisher to pay the freight, the real cost of developing a completely new encyclopedia with alternative measures, as well as historical essays, total baseball. That changed my perception, it changed my career, and we ran through 8 editions over 15 years. So there are lots of personal landmarks, but I never imagined that I would be around long enough to see 20-year-old college students participating in case studies, analyzing the stuff that was barely after dinner conversation at Sabre meetings 30 years ago.
Several of you have mentioned Pete Palmer. I think all of you have actually mentioned Pete Palmer. And Pete's data, Pete actually provides the Major League data banks here in baseball and around. So again, can you talk a little bit about Pete and what his contributions are? Because I think he's one of the unsung heroes in this field. All of you have worked with Pete, but we'll start with Pete here.
I should probably be last. I work with Pete daily now. Pete is retired from Raytheon. I always used to like how people hear someone say that someone's a rocket scientist. Well, Pete actually was. He was programming missile defense radars for Raytheon and have been in the evolutions to some side of the thing like we got now. Well, he has specific sightings to be talking about going there. Pete is a great guy, and he's still working at this pretty much every day. He also does done a lot of groundbreaking work in pro football, to a lesser extent, a little bit of work in pro basketball. And I was lucky enough to meet Pete by Project Score Sheet and work with him, and then work with him ever since. And then, of course, by Pete, I started working with John and the late Mike Richmond in pro baseball, which is truly exciting. I mean, it is one of the real benchmarks from our era. I didn't want, since you picked me ahead of John, I didn't want to talk about the Hidden Game and pro baseball and really kind of. So Pete has far-reaching influence. He's an incredibly gracious guy, and he started with Dick Kramer back when I was in high
school. Sure. Pete and I, actually, I'll give Pete public credit to make sure it's here in this community for what I think is one of the first great discoveries that I many of us came up with batting numbers, ways of measuring batting performance. They all look pretty much alike, they're transplants. But what Pete did fully was first, and it's probably even more important, was elucidating the relationship between run differential and runs and losses. This is something I can tell you, he certainly had well worked out by 1981 in our paths crisscross. And I should say that Sabre's responsible for the fact that Pete and I even got to know each other. It's ironic because we had lived only 2 miles apart, but had no idea of each other's existence. And I moved to Philadelphia, and he's still up in Boston. And, you know, and Saber, at that time, recruited people, not on the internet, but they put ads in the back of sporting news, classified ads, and just signed up and got there. And we were the only two people that, according to the other group, and that sort of thing. This changed, I think, for the better. But Pete, again, to underline, I think the thing that always strikes about Pete is what a gracious man he is, what a team-centered, how ardent he is about bringing everybody in the community, not grabbing the credit for himself, but trying to be as open and inclusive in all his activities. It's a very, it's a very nice human characteristic.
I'm proud to have, as Pete is my friend for 3 decades or more, he and Bob Carroll, with whom I did a good many bits, baseball and football over the years, were the two first people I met at my very first Sabre convention. So I met Pete in Toronto. And we did many, many things together. And the best thing I can say about Pete is something I don't say about many people, and that he is a genius. He is different from the rest of us. He's not just a clever fellow. He's not just a smart thinker. He is a different species. He's unlike the rest of us. So you're having a conversation with him on the couch, and all of a sudden, you realize that he has mentally just run up the street around the corner, and you have no idea where he is, and you have to run faster to just catch sight of him, not keep up with him.
And I have one thing about Pete. Pete, from the very start, keeps saying something that I think the community, we don't pay enough attention to, it's a little difficult for us, and that is the very great importance of noise, statistical variance, in the value of anything we do. It's an offsetting thing. We like the noise isn't there, but that these small deviations mean something. But he's the first person to make it very clear to do proper statistical analysis, proper confidence, proper use of plus one distributions. He's always done it. And he keeps saying it. He can never say it. But there's no doubt he's right.
Are there other heroes or other names that you think maybe don't have the aren't as well known as like Bill James's and some of those
others that I certainly mentioned James Smith. You know, he's not here. But if you ask me, what is the most miraculous thing? What has been a miraculous sort of incredible adventure, something out of a fairy tale? It's record sheet. The notion that you actually get out there and find, at this point, have essentially complete play-by-play records for the last 50 years.
Going back further.
This is all I spend my baseball time on these days, trying to move this along. But that's the most incredible, for me, that's the most incredible thing, is that can be done, it is being done. And Dave Smith's personal characteristics, both the parents' technical skills, but also the people skills. We all know that getting a voluntary effort to work together and achieve something effectively, this represents men, is again a really extraordinary accomplishment, I think.
I would say that people who helped rework the baseball analysis, Leonard Kopp is a guy that had a huge role and was very supportive of Sanders. He's a guy that, you know, since he died, I think he started
the writer in scale.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, he started with the New York Times in the East Coast, right. And then was one of the pioneers like in the West Coast. And Leonard Kopp was very influential, and to the extent that serious analysis penetrated, I think, the baseball writing community, which initially, in my experience, was somewhat hostile to it, and Leonard was responsible for that. I would also say Branch Rickey, again, Rickey had many other roles, but he was a champion of serious analysis in the game. And, you know, if we're talking about people who had huge influence, I mean, again, some in the audience, there's John Johnson in there. He's got much exposure at the conference here, but he's not, for whatever reason, he's been picked up. So John, again, mentioned his role in stats, and our stats. John?
I would offer F.C. Lane, who wrote articles for the baseball magazine from 1916 to maybe the late 20s that had sabermetric principles. He was irked by the inadequacies of batting average, irked by the inadequacies of other measures of individual performance within the team construct. One name that came up in Alan Schwartz's wonderful book, The Numbers Game, was George Lindsay, who I believe is still living, and George Lindsay's marvelous articles for an obscure to us, academic journal on operations research really laid the groundwork for much of the best work that sabermetricians did in the 1980s. So it's Lindsay, L-I-N-D-S-E-Y. If you choose to look it up, you will be stunned at the sophistication of the analysis. And the last one I would throw in there is Earnshaw Cook, who is dismissed as a crazy person, who was dismissed as a crazy person at the time and remains thus cast because he suggested that managers should never allow pitchers to bat. That every time a pitcher was due up at bat, you pinch hit for him, and then you replaced him with another pitcher. Well, I think it's about what we are, what we've got right now.
So I still see them let the pitchers hit and pull right the next game. That's just surprising and insane. I think F.C. Lane's book is actually on Google Books. I think it's because it's in the public domain now.
So and it was a Sabre publication. It would probably still be available.
I think it's available online.
It is in book for running part.
So you mentioned that you met Pete Pollard through Sabre. Were there other roles that Sabre had fostering the community? And then also, I think this conference is a great start, but what other roles do you see Sabre had adding perhaps going forward in the future? Maybe I'll
ask that. I think Sabre's biggest role was suddenly a critical mass of people. Prior to Sabre, you know, and I was not a founding Sabre member or even close to it, like it. I guess it was you weren't.
But how's later? I write you one.
I think that Sabre put together a whole lot of smart people who really cared about baseball, and a subset of those, I think not quite a small thing to suggest, because so many people I run into over the years, talking about Dick's work and how it was influential early, and Pete's work with the Statistical Analysis Committee. Sabre assembled a critical mass of people, which is like putting a whole bunch of scientists together at MIT. Sabre was like baseball at MIT, and by putting those people together, it unleashed a torrent of serious analysis, groundbreaking history and research, a new mindset that laid the foundation for what we see today.
Although, in fairness, if it weren't for Bill James, I was the leader.
Bill James is the godfather of us all because he was the first one to penetrate the popular mindset, and he blazed the path that the rest of us followed, even those who, like Pete, were at this game before Bill.
Can I add something? Sure. Another person who's extremely influential, we haven't mentioned yet, is Rob Meyer. I don't know if he's out here. Rob is probably more popular than anyone, or more responsible than anyone besides Bill James for popularizing this approach to the game.
Certainly he's my stepson. But you're asking a question I thought about where we should go from here.
Right, sure.
Well, I don't necessarily have an answer. I just clarifying the question.
I think the internet's made it. We used to all get together at the Sabre convention, so I would get on online.
Precisely.
And have our own
So this may be a transitory thing, but again, I think every organization like Sabre, and I know that Sabre still hasn't made up its mind about whether sabermetrics is a good thing all around. And I think that, I am tremendously impressed by this conference. I organized a state convention once upon a time, and the sophistication that every organization involved with information these days, we know, has to rethink its purpose, rethink its role, because the way technology is changing everything, making data really available, making communication about data, as you say, really available. And I really congratulate Sabre at this point in time for really taking a leadership for being proactive and moving forward and trying to build something that seems to fit, or at least address all the changes in the community for all of us, the commission of the community for all of us.
And if I may extend from that, I think Saber is in a unique position after its 42nd birthday to say that it has never sold itself out to anybody. There's never going to be a suspicion that Saber is behind a point of view because it's been paid to or because it is structurally appropriate to do so because of other alliances. So I think Saber may be uniquely positioned to be an underwriter's laboratory of Sabermetrics, where things that come out of conferences under its auspices may be evaluated on their face. I think that Saber is coming to embrace, after many years of diffidence, the statistical analysis part of its birthright. It was there from the beginning, and because we did so many other things, from roster building of college histories to Latin American baseball knowledge, that the statistical side languished for a while and met with some back of the hand treatment within the organization. I think that's changed. I think Saber is now glad to say that Bill James coined the term Sabermetrics to honor it for a reason.
So we often get questions at Baseball Reference about, well, why are these numbers different than what appeared in an encyclopedia a while back? And I think there's a view among a lot of fans that these numbers are sacrosanct, and this is the total, and the league decided this, and this is what it is, and wherever it shall be. Just wondering if you could talk a little bit about the fuzziness in the numbers, perhaps where that comes from, or if there are any interesting anecdotes about errors that you've seen being adopted in the encyclopedias.
We all can speak to this, so I'll need briefly to say that the fuzziness of the numbers is a product of the game. An official scorer in one place will rule a ball a hit, and another place will rule an identical play an error. So we tend to get married to the numbers as if they were real. They're not real. They are sublimations of activities. They're vestigial. They're ghosts of activities and actions on the field that are distant and irretrievable. They are markers. They are approximations. Now, a home run is not an approximation, but an error might well be. And even our recollections of famous events like the Merkle blunder, there were 50,000 fans who saw it, and there were 50,000 versions of what exactly took place on the field. So I think we ought to realize, while counting, shaping, and evaluating statistics, that there are limitations built in from the beginning, and that we should not be under the illusion that we're in an objective realm. There's subjectivity at the core.
There are a lot of stories, and Saber's full stories, of people dedicated years of their lives, sometimes their lives, to doing just a piece of research that not everyone takes for granted, whether it's strikeouts for a year, like strikeouts for a quarterback, strikeouts. In fact, I was talking to Jim Cassandro, Saber member two, when I came here yesterday. There's a Saber member in Phoenix, older, not in good health, who has, P. Palmer mentioned to me, has Saber, has some worksheets for data that was put into the Millen database in 69, where they just kept the results, not the preliminary. And that's critical. We may have to go back and correct that stuff. And we're trying to get in touch with them now, Saber is, to get those sheets scanned so we have the raw product. A lot of the 19th century, we don't have the source material. We only have what somebody at that time thought was the right number. That's a problem. I guess overall I would say this, and I've been saying this for close to 20 years now, that baseball statistics are incredibly accurate. I'm not sure I disagree with Judd, because he just got off the couch and ran up around the corner. They're incredibly accurate, and more accurate than anything else I've ever dealt with. And I think that we make life and death decisions every day, which car to buy based on freshness ratings, whether an airline is safe to fly now, they're all pretty much safe now. People used to make decisions based on the airline's crash record. Far better than that. Yet, they're not perfect.
They weren't handed down about Chadwick on the grade list like the Havlicks. They changed, and they're going to change more because of so many people, many of whom are Sabre members, some of whom now are not, going out and doing this research. And I think one of the benchmarks, again, in showing how Sabre baseball analysis has arrived, is that baseball reference, of course, now the gold standard on the web for this, is now providing. It's true, right? Well, it's true. It's now licensing, or it's the official statistic, right? You can correct me, for the Hall of Fame as of last year. And so now Pete Palmer's database is now providing the statistics view, which is now good enough for the Hall of Fame. And that's an important thing, that the Hall of Fame is core establishment. You haven't made it to where that's Major League Baseball's gold standard. But that means that Ty Cobb does not have the Hall of Fame anymore, 4,191 hits, and did not hit 367 for his career.
Now, are you all familiar with the story of Ty Cobb and the missing stat, the missing, the double entry and the missing hit, and how Lou Gehrig continues to get RBIs all these years after his death? You know all this.
We'll fill you in after.
But the thing about Cobb, I mean, that John referenced, we don't have time to tell the story here, is that this is more than 30 years old. Pete Palmer actually discovered that in, like, 1977. If the Sporting News broke the story publicly in 1981, baseball said there was a statute of limitations and a future correct Cobb record. We're more than three decades into this story and still haven't been recommended for baseball.
Well, as we heard this morning, we're a ton. We're going to make the record what we want. And that's what's happening in the information world. Again, broadly, generally, information is there are no obvious keepers of information anymore. We keep links and things like that. But actually, I guess record sheet is actually probably an organized way of comparing the original data with the official statistics. And I'll second what Gary said, that I do a lot of that. Probably entered 400 or 500 games per day in the record sheet. And looking at the scorecards, you know, he's got his programs. I think Tom Tippett wrote the programs that I use, and it's been a community effort in many ways. Even in fielding stats, which we're seeing those discrepancies, but frankly, nobody cares much about fielding stats on the average, the error rate is very small. But then I find discrepancies in what do I do? And actually, it's something I just sit by myself and decide, which can I trust? I generally decide I can't really trust the scorecard, at least unless it's perfectly obvious the scorecard can't be right, or that the official, sometimes you can't make the official numbers. There's nothing you can do to the scorecard, or no way you can say the guy's out for a beer or something and missed his play, so the fielding record ought to be this or that. So actually, I'm sort of making those decisions in this small area of fielding stats on a daily basis.
I just realized, John, that as I was distilling your biography, I feel like you are now the official historian of Major League Baseball.
But you didn't mention it, everybody knows.
Well, that's right. That's common knowledge.
Chinese don't give
it. I really wanted to ask if there was a secret vault where things were kept that the rest of us didn't know about. But I wondered, what goals have you set for yourself, and what will you consider to be a successful company?
I guess my principal goal as official historian is to convey to others the enormous pleasure of knowing a thing or two about baseball. That your pleasure in the present moment, going to a ballgame, watching one on TV, is so vastly enhanced by whatever background you bring to it. Now, I have a charge to chair the Origins Commission to issue a report, ideally by year's end, on what Major League Baseball will endorse as the best scholarly condensation of where Origins research stands at this moment. That is an official duty. Otherwise, unofficially, is to show up at places like this and wave the flag. I am the spokesperson for baseball's past, so some 15,000 players are utterly dependent upon me.
Now, Kent, I just want to make sure everyone leaves here with one incontrovertible fact, but you will not report that Abner Doubleday had anything to do with the origin of baseball.
That is a fairly safe bet, although I must keep my mind open.
Okay.
John,
we're fortunate to have such a fair argument.
Oh,
couldn't think too much. He had one of the greatest linebacker fans of all I ever heard when I saw John last year at the Seymour Conference, the Sabre Seymour Conference. And he, I can't remember what conversation we're having, but he said, after you go play the father of baseball, like Santa, who also the father of Christmas. And I've repeated that many times. It's like one of the best formulations of, you know, the best formulation of NCAA's role in baseball.
By not being historical, he has assumed a legendary role. And I think everyone in the audience can agree that legend is more powerful than fact.
He proved he's done a great place to have what it is.
So what are there any changes in how baseball data is presented now that you guys would like to see? Drop batting average, kill save, or any pet peeves that you like to see change?
That seems sort of petty. I have plenty of pet peeves. I would say that the big one I have is that it still annoys me that in common discourse, most people who work in the game still talk batting average, home runs, RBIs, innings pitched, wins, saves, ERA. I mean, most of them know there's stuff out there, and some of them actually use it, if you quote it. But it's astonishing to me how, you know, even with OPS, I remember the first time I saw OPS in a team media guide, or ESPN, you know, started putting it on. Actually, in the early 90s, ESPN first put on base percentage on the screen, which is a big deal. And then later OPS, and OPS becomes generally accepted. OPS is invented by Pete Palmer. But it's amazing to me how many people still just default to the standard inadequate set. You know, how many times do I see people list a batter's batting average, home runs, and RBI without even describing the number of plate appearances he had, the number of at bats, which would be making it virtually useless.
There's one little picky thing that you mentioned OPS brings to mind. We all know its on-base average is 40%, and the OPS you add them, but it actually has real virtues if you multiply them. The nice thing with this out then is actually the number you get is essentially equivalent to runs per plate appearance. But Pete points out, we're actually co-authors in the paper that first talks about multiplying it, but then in his own account, that is. He says it's easier to add than multiply. You know, it's not a point.
And I think he also believes, and maybe can verify, that OPS for individuals works while on-base time slugging is more accurate for teams.
Yeah, exactly. Pete would say that on-base time slugging is better for teams, and it's what you want to use if you want to say, we're looking at Mike Schmidt's value, look at a lineup of nine Mike Schmidts that we multiply. If we're looking at Mike Schmidt in a regular lineup, we add, although I'll defer to you since you probably had a 100-hour conversation about this.
Well, yeah. I mean, yes. Picking that up, the problem with the multiplication also is that you add up the individual players, they sum up something different than the team in that case. But there is a workaround, which goes back to the Scare publication I wrote in 1987. I'm sure you don't really care, but there is a workaround that gets you around that if you care about that.
So then we'll get on the
back. If I could offer a pet peeve, this one is actually growing. It's a burr under the saddle for me. It's the idea that we still have pitcher wins. We have 5 innings as a minimum for a starter. Though a successful start is now more or less defined as 6 innings. It seems to me that we're not very far away, perhaps a generation, from redefining that pitching stat to being a fractional contribution. Because if you look at any particular game over the course of a season, there may be several pitchers who have more of a role in securing victory for the team than the starter will gain credit for by virtue of hanging around the club. So, I mean, specialization, as Darwin says, is the trend of the universe. It's the trend of the species. It's the trend of the sport. I think Earnshaw Cook is going to wind up being right that we're not going to have starting pitchers at all, but we're going to have 12-man staffs of all relievers. Some may start a game, some may finish a game, but the role of the starting pitcher, I think, is going to change.
If you think about it, the win and the save probably dictate pitcher usage more than how the analysts might do it without those statistics. Now, if those statistics didn't exist, we might see completely different
and player agents, of course, included, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I heard yesterday that arbitration is largely arguing on this grounds. I think we're about ready to open it up for questions, so if you want to make your, get a microphone. I have one more question before we open it up. So I know there are aspiring Sabre nutritionists here, so so what skills or what traits do they need besides killer facial hair, by the way, do they need in order to become a leading Sabre nutritionist? It's almost a straight line. Teams with high OPS always score higher runs. Teams with low OPS.
always better if you multiply them.
Not true. Not true of batting average. Yeah, not as true of on base or slugging.
Majority of OPS is two times the batting.
Well, I mean that's part of on base to me. I mean it is value, but it's not. It's mid. I mean
batting average will give you points,
but it is not solely through that batting average. The other thing I would like to say is, in different OPS was really important before we had universal access to analytics on the web and before we had computers. When we were back to teasing out the sporting news, weekly statistics, how good a player was doing, and this, and, you know, you don't have to go back that far, they weren't even publishing puck stealings, and you don't have to go back too far before that, they weren't even publishing logs. The ability to get a reliable measure that you can figure out without spending your whole life doing it, which OPS gave you once they started publishing walks, was critical, absolutely critical. I mean,
let me just add one more thing on this Ferguson point. OPS is admittedly a mathematical basket, so mathematicians don't like it. I'll give them their point. It is a shorthand. It is a shorthand for runs created. It's a shorthand for linear weights. It's a shorthand for wind shares. It's a shorthand for wind shares. All of which are more complicated computations that marginally correlate with team runs scored and league runs scored somewhat better. But OPS is the Masonic handshake. You get right there, you have a complete understanding of how individual batting and team scoring correlate.
Other questions? In the back of the room.
100% normalized OPS plus. Right? We have the routine by the average. OPS by the average. The minus. 100%
it depends what you want to do with the numbers. For example, one of the things I'm lobbying over here for is if you want to compare players, for example, one of my pet peeves, another pet peeve, is what you use as your baseline. Is it replacement or is it average? If you want to know how good a player was, replacement does make sense. If you want to know what improves a team or doesn't improve a team, looking at what's average is all very useful.
The main reason is park factors. The major league stats are park adjusted, and we don't have the access. I generally take the point of view, if I can't do it for most of the years, I'm not going to do it because I don't want to have lots and lots of brain injuries for historical data. So that's the main reason. OPS Plus is park adjusted. We don't have the park factors. Question over here? PDF versions of the George Lindsay articles, if you're interested, please we'll see.
Yeah, this sort of goes to the pet peeves thing you were talking about at the end. I'd like, by the way, I agree on the hair and we should be blue hair regardless of the hair. So,
yeah. So moved.
And plenty of it. Well, if you use PEDs, you'll be pursued very bad.
I like to go. But anyway, to get back to pet peeves, his complaint was actually a rules complaint as much as anything. And so, yes, affected the staff, but it's because of the rule of the winning pitcher I myself have my own pet peeve, which is I don't like the boxer call because it is so subjective on the umpire, but yes, it's a rule. I would be curious as to your thoughts in terms of things like that, things that are inherent, codified in the game that you think are problematic in terms of understanding things in the context of how you could go back and maybe fix that. You could go back and check the historical.
Well, a perfect example, I think, of what you're pointing at is the blown save with, which was a discussion that we had at Sloan's MIT Sports Analytics Conference. There was a panel, Bill James, Dean Oliver, myself, John DeLong, and John Walsh. I think I got everybody right, John. And the discussion was that last year there were 64 instances, just last year, of a pitcher who entered into the lead, blew the lead, got credit for the victory, even though in many cases he was pulled for a pinch hitter after the winning run scored, so he never had to defend the lead he had just been given. This is also referred to as the vulture win on Phil Regan. Now, Bill's suggestion is that Major League Baseball may be very slow to change this rule, so why don't we just change it ourselves? Why don't we just establish a committee of elders or youngsters or whatever, and
experts.
And I think that's and the great thing with Project Breakfast, you can make it, bring me back and rescore all the games, all the information is there. For example, one of the thoughts I've had is, oh, what would happen if you had to sacrifice five rule apply consistently over all time? Who would the batting title winners be then? And again, it's a trivial thing to do.
Or the RBI.
Exactly. So, you know, again, we have the power. That's what we've discovered in the last 40 years. Originally, we were, you know, sort of, we didn't want to talk to people because they'd laugh at us. Even our colleagues in Sabre. And it's been extraordinary how it's changed.
I can just see it as being an interesting, not just an exercise, but I think tell you more about the game, the quality of the players versus the way that because you are getting rid of, you know, I agree, are.
Well, the rules always catch up to practice. The rules do not dictate practice, the rules catch up to practice.
Okay. If I had, my biggest pet peeve, which is not about statistics, about the rules, is that there should be no rules in the rule book that aren't enforced, simply, consistently, straightforwardly, and any unwritten rules that you're supposed to obey should be in the rule book. Baseball rules as a whole are the worst written set of rules I've ever seen. You can find games for six-year-olds that have better written rules than the baseball rules. And, you know, it's decades overdue for baseball to deliver all the rules. Put in the rules that actually are applied on the field, take out the rules that aren't, and actually write them in English instead of
blocking the plate.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
What
right.
Do you think actually
is
the hiding, like, against
block,
it's, like, against really big issue, like, some, that is, the way it's done now is so highly subjective. I mean, it's like the assumption of pitcher intent, and by most blocks, I don't think it crossed the pitcher's mind to try to pick the guy off necessarily. It's just you happen to, you know, do a catch and wind up, thought better of it for some totally unrelated reason in a block.
Right, and in the 1987 season, when they changed the rules, and all of a sudden,
all records did not change the rules. They changed R.G. Mahdi in the National League only, or was it in both leagues, ordered enforcement out of the balk rule as written, which drove the umpires crazy, which is literally impossible to do without destroying the game. And before the end of May, there were more balks in the major leagues than in any previous season in history. And I believe before the end of June, they had given up on it, going back to the actual way they do it, which is to have a crazy, uninterpretable, unintelligent rule, not interpreted according to the rule, and not interpreted consistently, which is what we have today.
And as you all know, unwritten rules aren't worth the paper they're written on.
Other questions?
One thing I think is very important when you're doing baseball research and statistics, you have to respect the history of the game. You have to respect the rules that were enforced at the time you're looking at. And you may not like that, and you may think modern rules are better, but you still have to respect what was going on. I know for a while there was an attempt, some Sabre patrician's part, to change batting champions or something because new rules didn't correspond with the old rules. And it's perfectly all right to say under modern conditions, X would have won the batting championship instead of Y, but Y won it according to the rules of the time. And I think that's important to keep in perspective.
I'm not aware of anyone who's done that.
That was very
baseball. No, but that's not what he said. He's saying that you apply different rules. What was actually done is the statistics that determine the batting championship at the time were found to be inaccurate, which is not changing the rules.
No, that's not what I'm talking about. There's a classic example, and I don't remember what year it is, but it's back in the National League in the 1920s, and a player won the batting championship with only 300 and some odd at bats, but that was correct according to the rules at the time, And
Bubbles Harder.
Yeah, and somebody in the Sabre publication, they said, no, this guy was not the batting champion. Paul Wanger was.
Well, we can't be responsible for everything Sabre's public.
I didn't say that. I think people need to be responsible.
I guess the 1918,
this isn't for adults.
I guess the 1918 batting title for that year sometimes given to us. Yeah, we didn't have enough. And but the most famous one is the 54, when Ted Williams did his plate appearances. And we haven't changed it. Bobby Avila is still the champion.
Yeah.
Even though, you know,
the total baseball, I mean, amongst the many groundbreaking things it did, came to the right solution on this. And this was regarding 1910, the Cobb-Lashway race, where Cobb was actually robbed of it. But when the certificate was corrected, it was found to actually have a lower batting average than Lashway. The decision that John Thorne arrived at, leaving consultation with a group of not so elderly people, was that
elders of Zion.
Was that we would create a total baseball, who was the champion, even if he had a lower batting average. So you look at total baseball, it's the same thing is true in Pizza My ESPN Baseball Wikipedia. Lashway is listed with a higher batting average and Cobb is listed as a batting champion.
Who's going to try it?
Which I think goes
to the point. But no, my point was a little different. Apparently didn't make it very well.
And that is,
applying modern rules to old situations where they don't apply.
Well, actually, part of what's wrong with what you're saying is that there aren't rules. There weren't rules at the time, and actually a rule doesn't pertain to scoring statistics. These scoring sections of the rule book aren't really rules, they're standards. And so, back when you're talking about these things, there were no standards, never mind any rules, for determining champions. People just said, I mean, look at Rookie of the Year, which is an award, not a statistic, but there were no standards at all. There are people who should have gotten Rookie of the Year award who dropped out of it because they were determined not to be rookies, and other people who shouldn't have gotten it. So we are, to make some historical sense of things, we are applying the best standards we can across time to have consistent analysis. It doesn't take anything away from anyone.
Oops, sorry.